Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to True Crimes Podcast. Today, I'll be speaking with William Crawford. William Crawford is a former reporter, writer, and legal affairs columnist for the Chicago Tribune. During a 23-year career at the newspaper, he was the recipient of a Pulitzer Prize, as well as many other major awards for his work. After leaving the newspaper, he was the Chicago Mercantile Exchange's Senior Vice President of Global Communications. In 2002, he co-founded O'Connell & Crawford LLC, a media strategy and crisis management firm. His book, called Justice Perverted, How the Innocence Project at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism Sent an Innocent Man to Prison, is Crawford's second book, and the documentary released this year, titled A Murder in the Park, directed by Christopher Reck and Brandon Kimber, is based on his book. So, Mr. Crawford, thank you for being on True Crimes Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for that introduction.
My pleasure. So how did you become involved in this case with Anthony Porter?
Okay, so the answer to that question involves several twists, but I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. Close to 5 years ago now, a longtime friend called and asked me if I would sit down with a Chicago policeman, friend of his, and do a story of some kind on a problem that policeman was facing with regard to an arrest he had made. I said yes, and a few days later I met Bob Dwyer, the Chicago policeman, who had been publicly and wrongly accused of forcing a confession from a prisoner by the name of Madison Hobley. Ultimately, Hobley was tried and convicted of an arson that killed his wife, his infant son, and five other residents of an apartment building on Chicago's South Side and sentenced to death. After listening to Dwyer, I agreed that I would look into the false accusations that he had forced a confession from Hobley, and then asked him where I could get my hands on a copy of the Hobley case. After Dwyer told me they were housed in the suburban offices of two retired alcohol, tobacco, and firearm agents who were now licensed private eyes, I traveled to their offices, introduced myself, and asked if I could take a look at the Hobley materials. Jimmy DeLordo, one of the two retired ATF agents, that said, and I quote, "We have the entire Hobley file, and you are welcome to take whatever you need." But he went on to say, "You are looking at the wrong case." And, you know, this could go on forever, but I will tell you, I made three or four returns to the offices of these two ATF agents asking for more Hobley files. And each time they said, "You're looking at the wrong case," I said, "All right, what case should I be looking at?" And they both turned to me and said, "You should be looking at the L. Story Simon Anthony Porter case." With that, I said, "All right, let me look at a couple of the materials you have on that." Took a look at them. They gave me some very sensitive documents, and the minute I read those documents, I realized, in fact, I was looking at the wrong case. I dropped the Hobley case and began investigating immediately, and this is 5 years ago, the L. Story Simon Anthony Porter case. That's the long and short of it.
Wow, and then that turned into your book.
I'm sorry?
And that turned into your book, How Justice Perverted?
Yeah, you know, that too gets a little complicated. But what happened is I went time and again back to the offices where these files were housed on the L. Story Simon Anthony Porter case. And again, there are key documents in there. They're explosive. My book, by the way, is not a he said, she said kind of deal. Every meaningful line in that book of any significance can be traced directly to the underlying record. And that is for two reasons. Number one, nobody would talk to me about this, because by the time I got to this, everybody realized a massive, massive injustice had taken place. So I'm nobody's talking to me about this case, so I'm stuck with the public record. Thank God for that. And the entire book is based upon the underlying record of this case, and nobody can dispute it. It's the sworn underlying record. But let me just tell you this, that after these two agents turned me on to this other episode involving these two, I took it upon myself to write a document called Kimmerer. And it's a 35,000-word report, and it's about 100 pages long. And again, it was a precursor to the book, but it was grounded in, and is grounded entirely in the underlying record. I sent this thing out, not through any publisher, not for any money. I sent it to every individual in the Midwest and even on both coasts that I thought were in a position or had the inclination to right an incredible wrong that had taken place. And guess what? This all went out. It was directly emailed to former assistant U.S. attorneys, to former U.S. attorneys here in Chicago, to deans of law schools, to professors at law schools here in Chicago, again on both coasts, even members of the general public. And guess what? The entire effort was met with stony silence. And it was only after that that I decided to do a book to give it some sort of cloak of respectability, as opposed to just something that's on the internet by somebody that nobody knows.
Wow. So it was after your book now that things started turning, started changing?
I'm sorry?
When did things start to develop where they started to right this wrong? Was it only after your book came out?
No. The Kimmerer preceded the book, and after the book was met with incredible silence by the general public, but was also met with extreme hostility by the media here in Chicago, and I'm a former member of the media here in Chicago, it was met by extreme hostility and silence by the general members of the general community that could have been in a position to right this wrong. They ignored it, and to the extent that they paid any attention to it, they attacked me. It was only then that I decided to put it in book form, and I got Amica Press here in Chicago to become my publishers. And the cloak of having a publisher of this expanded report gave it some respectability. And I must say, it's available on Amazon and all the other purchase platforms. It is enjoying brisk sales. It is doing very well and is being met with very glowing positive reviews.
Yes. So it's a great book. I'm still working on it. Now, but the documentary now, that just came out. How accurate? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. With regard to the documentary, I will say this. An awful lot of work, effort, and a fair degree of money went into the production of the documentary. And in my view, it is generally accurate. But also, in my view, it falls down in core areas. As you know, the heart of the Porter Simon case is this. David Protas, a once iconic, now disgraced, fired former professor at Northwestern University's famed Medill School of Journalism, where I was a longtime part-time professor, by the way, adjunct. He engineered an evil charade that caused one of the gravest miscarriages of justice in the recent history of Cook County court system. Because of this charade, Protas, working with a handful of witting and unwitting co-conspirators, freed from prison a convicted killer who had spent 17 years on death row following his conviction for fatally shooting a young couple in the pool area of the Southside Chicago Park in 1982. His name was Anthony Porter. And because of this sinister charade, an innocent man by the name of El Story Simon, in turn, was sentenced to 37 years for the double homicide that Porter had committed. My point is, to fully understand how this incredible upending of justice could have taken place, here's what you got to remember. I've read the entire underlying record. I have read the police reports. I have read the indictment. I have read the pretrial hearings. I've read the entire trial of El Story, of Anthony Porter. I've read the post-conviction efforts by various defense attorneys to get a rehearing for Porter, who was sentenced to death. I've read everything. And nowhere, nowhere in the underlying record does the name of a man by the name of Astore Simon appear. And where I believe this documentary is a little on the weak side, it doesn't take into consideration or understand Chicago and Cook County politics, which are unique to political systems in large cities across the country. It is the long history of corruption in Chicago, the notion that I will scratch your back if you will scratch mine at any price, that permitted this injustice to occur. Just, you know, just one comment on that point. In the 1980s, the FBI conducted an extended undercover probe of corruption in the Cook County judicial system here in Chicago. I was covering the federal courts at the time for the Chicago Tribune. I covered practically every one of these cases. The undercover probe was known as Operation Greylord. One thing one should note, when that probe concluded, nearly 90 individuals, policemen, court bailiffs, attorneys, and yes, more than a dozen sitting criminal court judges were convicted and sentenced to prison for playing varying roles in corrupting the county judicial system. That element, which remains unique to Chicago, I mean, maybe Baton Rouge, I'm not sure, but I am telling you, this upending of justice could only have occurred in the climate that continues in Chicago. And on that score, I think the documentary comes up a little short.
Right, because it is so much going on, so many people involved. Right. So how about these? Why did David protest and his private eye partner there, Paul Ciolino, what was their motivation for choosing Astore Simon?
I've probably been on 15 public forums now, and every time I'm asked that very question. And, you know, there are two responses that come from two bodies of individuals. One says that, you know, he was out to eliminate the death penalty, certainly in Illinois, if not across the country, and that he was willing to put an innocent man away and free a convicted killer in order to achieve his end, and that was the end of the death penalty in Illinois. And by the way, as a consequence of much of his efforts, there is no more death penalty in Illinois. I see it differently. I knew David Protest. When I started at the Tribune, he was with an outfit called the Better Government Association in Chicago. It's kind of privately funded outfit that looks for, you know, misgovernment and waste and corruption in local government in Illinois. He was a good guy. He's a nice guy. But over the years, the man changed, and I believe it was self-aggrandizement. When you look at, you know, some of the stunts that he pulled, and I am telling you, he pulled just about every joker out of the deck that he could find. He was offering shortened prison sentences that he could never have effected, but he was promising shortened prison sentences to convicted felons, people who had been convicted to murder and sentenced to 30 years, if they would recant their testimony. He was promising movie rights, huge monetary rewards to similar people if they would recant their testimony. Something he could not effect, but he was promising it. And he was promising, you know, I'm just going to tell you because it's in the lawsuit. He was promising sex with his female students to certain players in these various cases if they would alter their testimony.
Right. It's shocking. And the lawsuit is available online. Is he still in business, him and Ciolino?
Ciolino, it's a little unclear. I am told that he is no longer a private detective. I don't know that for certain. I'm also told that he filed for bankruptcy. I do not know that for certain. He certainly is in hiding, nowhere to be found. He was more than willing to get in front of the cameras years ago when he was freeing all of these people. And by the way, it's not just this case. If you look at the, and it sounds like you have, if you look at the federal case in which El Story Simon is suing the university, protests, Cialino, and his own lawyer, Jack Rimmon, for $40 million for railroading him, you will see in that lawsuit that his lawyers are contending that this was not an isolated case, that there are at least four or five others that are equally egregious, in which he and his students, who all thought this was on the level, by the way, being young, from upper middle class backgrounds, thinking this was they were heroes and heroines, you will find that in that lawsuit that he is alleged to have infected at least five or six other cases. So this does not stand alone. And I'll tell you another thing about the documentary. Again, because it doesn't delve deeply into the local politics that make this all unique, it fails to demonstrate, for example, that protests needed a corrupt defense attorney for this injustice to occur, and he got one in a man by the name of Jack Rimmon. And he needed a corrupt private eye, and he got one in Cialino. And he needed a Cook County State's Attorney to allow this wrongdoing to take place, and he got one in then Cook County State's Attorney Dick Devine, a protege of former Mayor Daley, by the way. And he needed a plotting, spineless assistant prosecutor for this crime to occur, one who would do the bidding of his boss, Dick Devine, and he got one in former State's Attorney Terry Gaynor, who now is a sitting Cook County Criminal Court judge. I mean, it's just incredible. Again, only in Cook County could this have happened.
Wow, so because of David Protest's connections, he was able to affect all these cases.
Well, what happened, and you got to remember this too, equally culpable in this is the local media. They became, and it's in my book, they became virtual cheerleaders for Protest. And Protest was manipulating them, aggressively and proactively calling them up, and he would make these accusations to further the case that he happened to be working on at the time. And the great, great failure, and this is a big part of my book, was the media's reluctance to look into the underlying public record to determine whether the fodder and nonsense that Protest was throwing out squared with the underlying record. Again, I have read 99.99% of everything that this record produced. It's lengthy, and by the way, in this day and age, when we have essentially bankrupt media outlets out there, the Tribune just came out of bankruptcy, the Chicago Sun-Times here in Chicago, it's going to fold any day now. The notion that they are going to send a four- and five-member team to look at these records for a 3 or 4 month period and come up with a five-part series and show the Protest was full of you-know-what, they simply took him at his word and ran with everything that he said without looking at the underlying record. I was a journalist for 25 years at the Tribune. I won a Pulitzer Prize there, among many other awards. And I am telling you, in the days when I was at the Tribune, I'm talking the mid-'80s, early 90s, it was nothing to spend 3, 4, 5 months looking into a complex situation and getting the record straight. None of that occurred here, and the press deserves a great deal of blame, an immense deal of blame for this, as do these students who were, you know, unwitting co-conspirators. But they moved this thing along, and it always made a great story that some 20-something white girl from an upper-income home in Wisconsin had ventured into very dangerous black neighborhoods to get to the truth.
Right. Now, is there a court case? Is there a date for this lawsuit?
Well, the court case stands as follows. It's a 50-page complaint. It was filed about 2 or 3 months ago. And before I mention the case, I'd like to just tell you this, that, you know, we have a Cook County State's Attorney here in Chicago now by the name of Anita Alvarez. She knew full well that I was working on this book. She knew that Kimmerer, the earlier version, was already out there. She also knew that a documentary was coming out. She was under extreme pressure. So what she did, much against her own better judgment, she was forced, because of the building pressure, to announce about a year and a half ago that she was going to reopen the Porter-Simon case and take a new look at the whole situation. Because she knew this book was coming out, she knew the documentary was coming out, so she calls 100 witnesses. She spends about 12 months, and last October 30, she goes before the chief criminal court judge of Cook County and says, "Your Honor, I'm asking that Elstory Simon, who has spent 15 of the 37 years he was sentenced to originally, needs to be freed, and he needs to be freed now." The judge immediately complied. Elstory Simon was immediately freed. She then holds a press conference, maybe an hour after Elstory Simon is freed by the judge. And she says, and I'm practically quoting her word for word, "This case has been so hopelessly corroded and so hopelessly corrupted by Northwestern University," she names the university, "by David Brotes, by Paul Cialino, and by Jack Rimland, the defense attorney who represented Elstory Simon at sentencing," she said, "had been so hopelessly corrupted and corroded that justice compelled her to seek Elstory Simon's release immediately," and she got it. So he's now out. He was out for about 2 years. About 2 months. He met with his attorneys. They filed a 50-page complaint, and it lays it all out now. The case is in federal court, and it's been motioned up, and it is now in the hands of a judge, and the judge has a central challenge facing him, or duty, and that duty is to decide whether this case has merit, in which case it will go forward. And I'm telling you right now, Northwestern University will settle this case. Will they settle it for $40 million? Don't know, but they're going to settle it, because they cannot take public testimony in a federal trial in the heart of Chicago, in which a former professor gets up there who was fired and is submitted to cross-examination about whether or not he offered sex and other favors to certain witnesses if they would change their testimony. Northwestern cannot take it. But the question is the judge going to allow this to go forward? Is he going to allow it to be heard by a jury, or is it going to be thrown out? That's the great unknown. In my view, it's got all the merit in the world, and it should go forward.
Wow. So it took your book and a documentary before they finally released him.
Oh, you betcha. I am telling you, but for Kimmerer, the first iteration, but for the book, which they knew was coming, and but for the documentary, Elstory Simon would still be sitting down in Danville State Prison.
Wow. Amazing. Wow, that's great work. I mean, that's amazing. And there's more people that are in the same position as Elstory Simon was due to... Now, these innocence projects, they seem to have this prominence with the media. I guess that's why the media was so friendly to them.
Oh, they had, look, I mean, it was, they were doing God's work. You've got these young kids running around, upending cases that are 30 years old on the flimsiest of evidence. But there was such a drumbeat going among the media about what a wonderful guy Protes was, what a hero he was, and what magical work that the students were doing, that it was practically hysterical here. And
what was your experience with Protes? He threatened you, didn't he, when you tried calling him?
Oh, that's a good question. So So at one point, you asked me, you know, what was the response? Number one, nobody cooperated with me. I guess I mentioned that. And that's why I went to the underlying record. And it's fine. I'd rather have the underlying record than somebody saying he said, she said, blah, 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 blah. So I called Cialino, and he promptly hung up the phone on me. He says, those are in my notes. Notes are filed away someplace. And the last thing I'm going to do is go look for my notes because you're asking me to. So then I called protest. I called him, I guess, but I emailed him ultimately. And I said, hey, Dave, I said, I'd like to sit down with you and talk to you about the L. Story Simon case. He shot back within I don't know, a day, with an email which listed out something like, I don't know, 12 or 15 of all the addresses that I had called home for the last 28, 30 years. And then, after listing those out, I mean, he went to the trouble to ask somebody, probably Cialino, to find out where I used to live. So he got all my addresses. After he lists them out, he then says, which of these current addresses do you call home? I am going to send Anthony Porter and his friends to pay you a visit. Now, do I take that as a genuine threat? No. That's just the madness of protest, in my view. I don't think Porter was ever going to make a visit to my house. But I find it truly, truly interesting that when he's going to even pretend to inflict harm on me, he comes up with the name of a guy who he freed from prison because he was falsely convicted. And by the way, if you look at the underlying the transcript of the trial of Anthony Porter, it is the most ridiculous proceedings in the history of mankind. Porter never takes a stand. He puts an alibi witness. I don't know if you've read this, but he puts an alibi witness on, his star alibi witness, who says, under direct examination by his attorney, Anthony Porter could not have killed those two people that night because at the time of the shooting, we were in a play lot, sitting on swings, smoking dope and drinking wine and talking about the old days, okay? Under cross-examination by a state's attorney, this is at the underlying trial that led to his conviction and his sentence to death, the alibi witness is asked by the state's attorney, are you a member of a gang? Yes, I am. Is Anthony Porter a member of a gang? Yes. Is he a higher-up? Yes. Are you a higher-up? No, I'm just an underling. And what does an underling do? Whatever it takes. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean fighting? Yes. Does it mean killing? If asked to kill, we'll kill. Now, this is his alibi witness acknowledging that as a member of a gang, if Porter asks him to go out and kill somebody, he'll do it.
Mm-hmm. And that he would testify for him because he's a gang member. So they give each other alibis.
Correct.
Yes,
correct.
Yes, I read that. It's right, yeah. Unbelievable. I'm just surprised. What was, now, Cialino and Protest, what was their connection? How did they get together? Do you know?
Well, you know what? Early on, Protest held a variety of different positions. He was a professor at Loyola. He was at the BJ, Better Government Association, as I mentioned, but he also was a reporter for the Chicago Lawyer. It was a weekly publication and kind of a muckraking publication that was owned by Rob Warden, who became a colleague of Protest's ultimately up in the law school at Northwestern. And the two of them would work these wrongful conviction cases together. When Rob Warden owned that publication, which he later sold to the Chicago Law Bulletin, Protest was a guest writer for Warden's publication. At the same time, Cialino became very involved with the Chicago Lawyer as kind of an investigator. And so that's where he met Protest. Now, let me tell you something. You try and get a job teaching. I taught at Medill, graduate and undergraduate. You try and get a job up there if you're a non-working journalist and you don't have a degree. There's no way in the world you're going to get hired. try getting a job without demonstrating that you have a master's degree. Then you maybe with some luck, you'll get a job up there. But here is Cialino. He's got 2 years at a junior high school, or a junior college, and this is after attending something like 12 different junior colleges. And I don't know what the hell he got his degree in, but he never got a four-year degree, and he certainly doesn't have a master's. And beyond that, the man got involved in two very, very bad scrapes with the law. One, as a private investigator, he went to the home of a South Suburban man here in Chicago, pulled out a gun, and threatened to put a bullet in his head if he didn't stop harassing one of Cialino's clients. He cheated another woman out of some money in another case. Now, you tell me, Northwestern University, I mean, this is not some junior college. This is Northwestern University. Not only is it Northwestern University, it's the Medill School of Journalism. And here you've got a guy with two scrapes with the law, serious scrapes. He's threatening to shoot somebody. And he doesn't have a four-year degree, much less a master's degree. And he's working with the faculty of the Medill School of Journalism. And wow. He, by the way, he is the man who forces the illegal confession from El Story Simon during an uninvited, kick-the-door-in visit to El Story Simon's Milwaukee home. He poses as a police investigator. He lies. He threatens El Story Simon with his life. And there are no students there. I mean, how is this a journalism student? Protest isn't there. There are these two private investigators. Now, they're working directly at the direction of protests, but there's no students involved. This is not a journalism class. Again, I taught journalism for years, not only in Northwestern, but every major university here in Chicago. And I mean that literally. And never did I ask a private investigator to kick down the door of somebody's house and force a confession from them. It's crazy.
Right. And he was finally fired after only 2 decades or so.
Oh, was he fired? Was he fired? And this is in connection with yet another case. But he pulled the same stunt in the other case that he had pulled in these 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 other cases. It's called the McKinney case. And his conduct in that case had become so outrageous that the university summarily fired him after 29 years. And you got to look it up. It's in my book. They put out a lengthy statement in which they blow by blow tell the entire world why they are getting rid of this.
Oh, good. Well, you know, unfortunately, we've run out of time. But are you working on a new book? Are you coming out with another one? Or
I you know what? This has taken 4 or 5 years out of my life. I really don't know that I've got it in me to do another one. But what I am doing is, again, this is enjoying brisk sales. It's enjoying positive reviews. And I'm pitching the book around town, and it's picking up some steam, and that is making something worthwhile.
Oh, yes. Your book is wonderful. You can get it on Amazon.com, Justice Perverted. Thank you for being on True Crimes Podcast.
I certainly appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.